Hey everybody, welcome to Disparity again. This is the podcast where we go through a book chapter by chapter so you can get really familiar with it without actually reading it. And we like to go through the classics, and we got another one for you today. I am here with Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
And I am here again with the wonderful Kalina.
Aw, hey, that means Brian's not wonderful.
Yep, specifically. Yep, no, stick around for an episode or two, you might earn your title of wonderful.
All right.
Yeah, so this is the podcast where we go over classic books so you can get to know them without having to read them. But once again, we do always recommend that you read the book. Reading the book is an important fundamental experience, and, you know, you should really read more. So, yeah, read the book. But we'll get into that in a minute, because today's book is a science fiction classic, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Ooh. By Jules Verne. Yeah. Brian, have you ever read this book?
I think I read this when I was in elementary school, maybe. It was like one of those, you know, the series of books that has Moby Dick and all of those classics. I remember there was a squid or something on the cover, and I was like, oh, squid, that's awesome. I want to read that one.
Yeah, like the little short and condensed ones, right?
Maybe it was, yeah. I think it might have been like an abridged for kids version of the book.
I was about to say, damn, what elementary school did you go to? That's really advanced, isn't it? Isn't it like a real, I don't know anything about this book, so I thought it was like a really hard read.
Have you read this one, Kalina?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
All right, well, you know what that means, Kalina. You're going to regale us first with the plot of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. What's this book about?
The ocean.
That's all you got, really?
Hold on. 20,000 leagues under the... Okay, wait. I have a new theory. It's about a kraken, and they're going to shoot it with a harpoon gun.
Ooh, that's I like that.
Partially on, probably.
Yeah.
Spoilies! Nice.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing to notice, another thing to mention. Yeah, spoilers. If you plan on reading this book, we're about to explain the entire plot to you. So, spoiler alert right off the bat here. So, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This book is by Jules Verne. It was written in 1870. It was published in English in 1872. Jules Verne is French. Some people call Jules Verne the father of science fiction, but that's actually a contested title between him and H.G. Wells, who wrote War of the Worlds. But Jules Verne also wrote Around the World in 80 Days and Journey to the Center of the Earth. He was big into the fantastical science fiction type stuff. I almost titled this episode 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or Why Taylor Doesn't Like Science Fiction, because this book is just the poster child for the things I personally hate most about science fiction, which is another reason why if you are actually really interested, you should read this book yourself, because I'm going to give you a bit of a biased perspective. I personally don't actually like this book, but we're going to go through it anyway. You guys ready to roll?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Part 1, Chapter 1, A Shifting Reef. So the first chapter of this book, the first line, one thing about 19th century, early 20th century authors is that they talk so much more, they talk prettier than I do. and so the first line of this book is a good way to encapsulate it. Quote, "The year 1866 was signalized by a remarkable incident, a mysterious and puzzling phenomenon, which doubtless no one has yet forgotten." End quote. So this book was written in 1870, and it's basically contemporary. It takes place in the late 1860s. I think the actual story starts in like 1868. But the narrator starts out talking about how in 1866, some crazy stuff happened. And there's basically some weird things that have happened out on the ocean. Quote, "Vessels had been met by, quote, an enormous thing," end quote there. "A long object, spindle-shaped, occasionally phosphorescent, and infinitely large and more rapid in its movements than a whale." End quote. So there's something huge and crazy out in the ocean that there's like been a few legendary incidents with.
It's a shark.
It might be.
Is it a phosphorescent shark?
Yeah.
That's
Dude,
badass.
Sharks are scary. Can you imagine a glowing shark?
That would actually be easier to see, though.
Like, I would you could be see so it coming. Freaked out.
Yeah. It would be pretty scary. So there are some specific incidents. In 1866, some ship sees something close to the coast of Australia. They think it's a sandbank, but then it shoots like two giant whale spouts. They report it shoots whale spouts like 150 feet in the air. And then 3 days after that, another ship sees something similar, but it's 2,500 miles away. Which, in 1868, the idea, or 1866, the idea of something traveling 2,500 miles in 3 days is insane. Like, that does not happen. And then, about 15 days after that, and 2,000 miles from that point, two ships communicate to each other that they've both seen it, and they say, oh, this thing is, like, 350 feet long. But there's multiple reports. There's reports where it's like, oh, it's 200 feet long. And there's another one that's like, no, it's a mile wide, and it's 3 miles long. And to put that into perspective, the longest blue whale to ever live is about 100 feet long. So even the lowest estimates is this thing is gigantic. It's huge.
Can you give me that in football field yards? How long?
That's one feet? American football field. I'm assuming you meant American football field and not them damn European football fields.
Yeah, but isn't that 100 yards? So it's like, what, a third of a football field?
Yes, no, you're right.
Is Taylor even American?
Yeah, no, right. Do you even American, bro? I even called soccer football in my little American sentence. I did that all over the place. Soccer. Anyways. So yeah, the world's news is like buzzing about this, like all the newspapers and stuff. Scientific journals start having articles about it, speculating on what it is. Even to the point that there's some satire articles, and after the satire, everyone's like, okay, this thing is kind of a joke, nothing happens for a while, and people kind of forget about it. But then, in March of 1867, a ship hits something really hard out in the middle of the ocean. Like, they're not close to a shore at all, and it hits it so hard it cracks the keel.
What's the keel?
The bottom of the ship.
Ah.
Yeah, there's going to be some nautical terms here. And then the next month, April 1867, another ship is struck really hard while it's out at sea, and the crew, it like starts taking on water, and the crew discovers like this perfect triangle shaped hole that's about 6 feet, that's 2 meters for you non-Americans, in diameter, that has been punched into the bottom, and quote, piercing an iron plate 1 3/8 inches thick, end quote. So something like punches a giant hole in the bottom of this 1860s steel ship. And at this point, the public opinion is, you know, like the buzz is back about this monster. And the public opinion is that this monster, whatever it is, needs to be hunted down. And that's basically the gist of the first chapter.
Okay. So are they hunting this thing? Whoever our protagonist will be?
Ah, well, that's where the next chapter starts.
So it is a kraken. What else makes a triangle-shaped thing? I feel like I've, like, seen a picture of this somewhere. I've definitely never read this book, though. So I'm like, because, like, isn't that an iconic picture? Like a harpoon in a kraken?
I mean, I think I know what you're talking about, but I feel biased because I have seen the pictures, like the illustrations from this book. And now I don't actually remember.
Did he?
It does have some illustrations.
Oh, that's cool.
Chapter 2, Pro and Con. So in this chapter, we learned that the narrator is actually also the main character. He's the assistant professor in the Museum of Natural History in Paris. And he's in New York City right now, and he's about to leave for France. And he's like the world's foremost expert on like undersea things. He's read all about the quote-unquote monster, and he's really interested in about it, and he's in New York City, and New York City is all excited about the creature, the monster, the machine, whatever it is. And he determines from his expertise, there's only two options. It's either a gigantic creature or an incredibly advanced submarine. And he actually goes point by point as to why he doesn't think it's a submarine. He says, first of all, where and how was it built? How did if it really is a submarine vehicle of some kind, how did you build this massive wonder of technology and keep it secret? And if it was like some government, if it's some advanced government project, how could a government keep something like that secret from other governments? Which is kind of funny. So a couple quotes here. Quote, for a private gentleman to keep the secret under such circumstances would be very difficult, and for a state whose every act is persistently watched by powerful rivals, certainly impossible, end quote.
I just think he sounds bad at keeping secrets himself. but or aliens. He didn't think of aliens. I would totally think an alien built this thing.
Dude, that's true. He should have thought of aliens. Man. Yeah. But this was also like 75 years before the Manhattan Project, where it was clear. You know, it's very clear that a government could keep something secret from other governments. But anyways.
They weren't tweeting about it back then.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Xing about it. Sorry.
Oh, no, 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 no. It's still tweeting. Don't be doing that. Oh,
is it an X? I thought it was a cross. They call it cross in Europe, don't they?
Just like they call football soccer. Damn. Anyways.
No, no. The opposite. Oh, my God. Taylor's not American.
And then also this quote, quote, after inquiries made in England, France, Russia, Prussia, Spain, Italy, and America, even in Turkey, the hypothesis of a submarine monitor was definitely rejected. End quote. So apparently they asked around the governments and the governments were like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I guess that's proof enough.
Man, he just really takes everyone's words.
I know. The All governments right. could be hiding the aliens and he'd totally believe them. So anyways, public opinion begins to demand an opinion from the narrator. This narrator who's like this foremost expert, right? His book, he has a book about undersea things and all of his publications. They give him like an expert reputation and people want to know what he thinks. So he publishes a scientific article about it, like an actual scientific paper. And this is, oh my God, quote, I give here an extract from a carefully studied article which I published in the number of the 30th of April. It ran as follows, end quote. And this section, next section of the book, is literally a fake scientific paper. So, like, if you really like reading scientific research papers, wow, is this book for you. But yeah, it's very dry, but it's luckily it's not the whole paper. But yeah, it's literally just a snippet of a scientific paper written by this guy in this book. And so in the scientific paper, he considers the giant hole punch in the bottom of this ship. And he goes through all of his logic and some of the stuff about submarines, I think, that we talked about earlier. And he says, all right, my hypothesis as an expert is it's a gigantic narwhal.
Nice.
So, yeah. So, quote, the common narwhal, or unicorn of the sea, often attains a length of 60 feet. Increase its size fivefold or tenfold, give it strength proportionate to its size, lengthen its destructive weapons, and you obtain the animal required. End quote. So, the actual longest narwhal, I looked this up, ever found was about 18 feet long. So, you'll see kind of a pattern in this book of Jules Verne either really likes to exaggerate the big fish stories, or he just really makes numbers up, because... yeah, that's not even close. It could also be the fact this book was written in 1870, and it could very well be that the scientific knowledge at the time was just dead wrong. but yeah, that would be a ludicrously large narwhal.
Maybe he saw a really big narwhal and it was unrecorded. And he was like, that, it's three times that size.
Yeah, maybe this is like pre good recording methods. And someone said, no, I saw a 60-foot narwhal, and everyone's like, that's ridiculous. Did you get a picture? And like, what is a picture? And that, yeah.
Dude, this is just fish story stuff. It's classic. You always got to add 100 feet. I caught a fish in Tahoe. It was this big, you know, plus 100 feet.
And your arms just spread out for like an entire soccer
field. Yeah, yeah. It's always the wingspan plus 100 feet. it's all you can communicate without a picture.
So anyways, the narrator's paper is received pretty well, and it's generally regarded as the solution, right? Newspapers and governments are like, look, this guy's the expert. He probably knows what he's talking about. So the United States government decides they're going to hunt this thing down. They commission this steamship, which is like top of the line modern for the time, called the Abraham Lincoln. And they decide, all right, we're going to go hunt this thing down. But then there's no more sightings of it for months. So the Abraham Lincoln is like waiting to go. But no one else sees the monster. Then a ship sees it in the North Pacific, or at least some they think is it in the North Pacific. And that's about 3 weeks prior to this story. So the ship is about to leave from Brooklyn to go hunt this thing down in about 3 hours from this point when the narrator receives a letter. And it basically says, Monsieur Pierre Aronnax, we hope you would join us and go on this expedition. So this is where we learned that the narrator is Pierre Aronnax. And the book always refers to him as M. Aronnax, which I'm assuming stands for Monsieur. You know, someone can angrily comment and prove me wrong. But yeah, so he's basically referred to as M. Aronnax for like the rest of the book. And he the letter says, we need you to go on this expedition. And the chapter ends with a letter. That's the end of that chapter.
Does he accept?
We'll see. Chapter 3, I Form My Resolution. So you can guess what this chapter's about. Aranax feels that it's like his life's purpose to go find and hunt down this creature. He's like been this undersea study guy forever, and this is the ultimate of undersea mysteries, so he's decided he's going to go. He's in New York City. He's here with his servant, Conseil. Conseil's an interesting character. He's a very calm and determined, smart, skilled guy, and he's utterly devoted to Monsieur Aranax, like self-destructively motivated.
Oh my God, he's in love with him.
Yeah. He never complains, like, ever. And it's kind of weird that there's, like, a class thing going on, or like, a servant thing going on, because Aranax constantly refers to him as a boy, or the boy, even though he's 30 years old, and Aranax is 40 years old. So, yeah, it's, yeah.
It's giving me some Watson and Sherlock vibes. Of, like, yeah, Watson's right? dedication to Sherlock, and everyone knows he's just in love with him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, their love cannot be broken. So Aranax tells Conseil, he, like, you know, the book says he refers to him sharply, like, Conseil, like, get in here, right? He says, hey, we're going to go on this expedition, and we need to make ready. And Conseil's like, well, wait a minute. What about all your studies and all of your specimens you've collected and that kind of stuff? And Aranax says, oh, don't worry, it'll all be fine. This is, like, really important. We have to go on this expedition. So they go to the Abraham Lincoln, and they meet the commander of this ship, whose name is Commander Farragut. And they go on board, and the ship takes off. And there's, like, a huge crowd, because, like, people know that the Abraham Lincoln is going to hunt this monster, and the monster's been all the buzz of the news. And so a whole crowd sees them off. And they're off to go find the thing. And that's the end of that chapter.
Are they still running under the narwhal assumption at this point?
Yeah. Yep. At this point, they are still convinced that Aranax is right, and it's a giant narwhal. They are aware. They're aware that it could not be a narwhal. And some of the men on board you'll see soon are like, that can't be right. But yeah, at this point, they're still under that assumption. Chapter 4, Ned Land. So everyone on board is excited for the adventure. There's a bunch of crew members, and they're all watching for the creature. Everybody's got their telescopes. Everybody's trying to climb the mast and look out for the creature. You can tell that Commander Farragut is, like, a really great commander, and everyone trusts him. And the commander has offered a $2,000 prize to whoever spots it first. And remember, this is 1870, which I can't remember if I used ChatGPT to convert this or what, but that's about 50 grand. Today. So he basically says everyone on board, whoever spots this thing first, I'll personally give you $50,000.
That's wild.
Yeah. So this boat is like this really premier ship in the U.S. Navy. It's got a bunch of guns, harpoons, cannons, that sort of stuff. Quote, thus the Abraham Lincoln wanted for no means of destruction. And what was better still, she had on board Ned Land, the Prince of Harpooners. End quote. Or harpooners, as it says. Anyway. So, yeah, this is where we meet Ned Land. Ned Land is a French-Canadian. He's about 40 years old. He's this big, strong dude who's basically described as, like, you know, the deadliest, hardest harpooner in the world, right? So Ned and Aranax, the main character, they bond on, like, their Frenchness, because Ned speaks French and Aranax is French, and so they kind of become friends. And they talk for a while about the creature, and Ned is like, well, I don't know. I kind of doubt that you're right about this. I've been around. I've seen whales. I don't know if it's a narwhal. I don't believe that. But then Aranax goes into, like, this big detail of the math of water pressure as, like, his argument, which kind of leads to what I like to call reason number one of why I personally don't like science fiction, is that it's often more about the science than it is about the plot. So this here, just as a little snippet, here's a quote from Aranax's argument to Ned Land as to why he thinks it's a narwhal. Quote, At 320 feet, this pressure equals that of 10 atmospheres, or 100 atmospheres at 3,200 feet, and of 1,000 atmospheres at 32,000 feet, that is, about 6 miles, which is equivalent to saying that if you could attain this depth in the ocean, each square 3/8 of an inch of the surface of your body would bear a pressure of 5,600 pounds. End quote. Like, it's meticulously detailed. And it goes on like this for a while, with, like, specific numbers and stuff. So you can tell that, like, Jules Verne is kind of a nerd about this stuff. And to be honest, I know, like, I can look up easily, like, how long was the longest narwhal and that sort of stuff to prove him wrong. This stuff, I'm not even going to bother. I'm just going to take his word for it. Because I'm not doing that.
So Taylor likes science fiction if it doesn't actually explain anything in it. The faker it looks, the more he's into it. Don't explain anything to Taylor. Well, hey,
you said I like science fiction. That's where you're wrong. Yeah. I only like fantasy.
If they don't explain anything, and you're like, yep, that could happen.
I like fantasy where they're like, a wizard did it, and you're like, awesome. That's what I like, man.
I can appreciate it, though. Like, having a factual basis in what he's trying to convey and using scientific reasoning to present it. I think that good science fiction does do that, where, you know, like Hollywood science fiction, they just like throw around jargon and, you know, hope the audience is stupid enough to not actually pick up on it.
No, I totally agree. I do see the value in this. And like, I have to admit that like when he goes into like some of these deep numbers, I'm like, wow, like this author really tried to riff his fantasy world, his make-believe world, off of the real world, which is kind of the point of science fiction. I just don't care. I just don't think it advances. It doesn't advance the plot to me, but I guess, you know, in a way it does. But again, that's why don't take my word for it. As they said on Reading Rainbow, is anybody old enough to remember that? So I just can't stand these. But anyways.
Dude, that means the editor of his book had to double check all of his math.
I doubt that. I bet the editor was just like, yep.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yep.
I want to know if it's all correct.
It's up to his peers to peer review him and rebuff his bad claims. The editor just makes sure that he doesn't say football instead of soccer. So he uses this this big argument as justification as to why, look, oh, I'm right. It could totally be a giant narwhal. And the chapter kind of ends with them kind of going back and forth. And it ends with Aronnax basically saying, well, if you don't think that it's a giant narwhal, then how do you explain the accident on that boat? And that's the end of chapter 4. Chapter 5, At a Venture. So they're on the Abraham Lincoln. They've been sailing in the ocean for a few days, and they run into a few whaler ships. And the whaler ships say, hey, we heard you had the legendary Ned Land on board. We spotted some whales, and we were wondering if we could get his help. And Commander Farragut, the captain's like, sure, yeah, you can have Ned Land for a little bit. And so he goes over to that boat and they go off. And while he's there for like just a couple hours, they kill two whales with Ned Land's help. And Aronnax is super impressed. Quote, decidedly, if the monster ever had to do with Ned Land's harpoon, I would not bet in its favor. End quote. So Aronnax is feeling pretty confident that, you know, hey, we got all these guns. We got Ned Land. I think we've got a pretty good shot at taking this thing down.
I think Ned's going to die.
Ooh,
I'm going to just call that right now. He's like the best of the best. And it's going to be like, oh my God, it killed Ned. What are we going to do, guys?
Man, how dramatic would that be? But you'll find that drama is not in the interest of this book. Anyway, so they sail around Cape Horn. You know, that's off the coast of South America, the very base of South America. And they're into the Pacific Ocean. Because this is 1870, there is no Panama Canal, so they have to go all the way around. So they sail for like days and days to do this, right? So excitement and tension on the boat are very high. Every time they spot anything that's like a whale or a sandbank, the whole ship like jumps on deck and everybody's looking. Quote, hearts palpitated, fearfully preparing themselves for future incurable aneurysm. The entire ship's crew were undergoing a nervous excitement of which I can give no idea. They could not eat. They could not sleep. End quote. So they're all super excited to find this thing now that they're in the Pacific Ocean, because that's the last place it was sighted. So now they're into its territory. They've been out for about 3 months at this point. This is, you know, late 1800s. So sailing time frames are nuts. Like, just to get from point A to point B is like several months. Very often. So they've been out for about 3 months and they haven't seen anything at all. They've been going around the Pacific Ocean for a while to the point that the crew is getting angry. Commander Farragut decides that, all right, fine. Like, they made it all the way to Japan and they're searching around Japan. And he says, all right, we'll search the Pacific Ocean for 3 more days and then we'll give it up. We'll turn back. They're getting so desperate to find this thing that they actually take a bunch of the ship's bacon and they trail it behind the boat, trying to bait this thing. They get in all of the life rafts and like the little dinghies, and they go out in boats, smaller boats, like in all directions, like to cover as much territory as possible. And they still haven't spotted anything.
Hold up. Are whales known to like bacon?
No. Narwhals are known to like bacon. Okay.
Is that true?
No. giant electric narwhals that pierce ships are known to like bacon. There's a Reddit joke in there somewhere.
If they're trying to pick up people, you know, in a submarine that haven't had bacon in a while, then it's probably a good idea. Let's hope it works.
Yeah, there you go. Dude, like, yeah, I think that's... They looked at all their food and they were like, all right, if I were down there, what's the one thing that would get me to swim for like hundreds of miles?
Definitely.
Yeah, bacon. And it was the bacon.
I can't believe they gave that up. No wonder they're so angry.
Yeah, I'd be pissed.
So they're 200 miles off the Japanese coast. It's 8 p.m. on the final day. So once tonight's over and the next morning comes around, they're going home. So this is it. Conseil, who is Aronnax's servant, and Pierre Aronnax are talking about how they should have just gone home to France. This is a crazy endeavor. When all of a sudden, who else but Ned Land shouts, quote, look out there, the very thing we are looking for, on our weather beam, end quote, whatever that means. And that's the end of the chapter. So Ned has spotted something.
Damn. Rich get richer.
Ned's just so awesome. It'd be really dramatic if he died.
That's what I'm saying. I hope he has a will.
For that 50 grand,
I'm calling it now.
Chapter 6, At Full Steam. So everyone on the whole ship, the whole crew, comes up to see it. It's now past 8 p.m. It's getting very dark. And about 500 yards away from the ship, which is like, what, 400 meters-ish? Again, for our known Americans. But to be fair, though, this guy is French, and like, this is the measurement he was using at the time. Like, when I throw a measurement out there, it's not because I convert it to my Americanism. It's because I'm using the measurement that he measured. And if I don't use the measurement he measured, it's because I converted it, because he often uses lengths like cables. In fact, for this measurement, he says at 2 cables length from the Abraham Lincoln, which I had to look up because I had no idea how long a cable was. So yeah, this one's about 400 meters away. Anyways, it's that far away from the boat, and the sea is lit up like there's a big spotlight coming up from underneath the water. And someone says, oh, it's just like a bunch of phosphorescent, like bioluminescent algae. And Aronnax, who being the sea expert, is like, oh, there's no way. And he gives like his reasoning. And then he says, well, I guess it doesn't matter now, because whatever that thing is, it's rushing towards us right now. And everybody starts to wonder what to do while this thing starts bolting towards them. And Commander Farragut says, throw it in full reverse. And they start reversing as fast as they can. But it's moving at least twice their speed. And it comes clear that they're not going to outrun it. Quote, it made the round of the frigate, which was then making 14 knots, and enveloped it with its electric rings like luminous dust. Then it moved away 2 or 3 miles, leaving a phosphorescent track. End quote.
Okay, wait, what's a knot?
Oh, like nautical miles? Nautical miles per hour?
How fast is that?
Oh my god, that's what that means? moving at like 3 knots means 3 nautical miles.
So 1 knot is 1.15 miles per hour. So it's almost miles per hour.
Wow. Today I learned. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, according to a quick Google search, I hope I'm right. Again, if someone really wants to, like, you know, send me a nasty message after this and be like, that's actually not true, then I would love to read your giant, boring, numeric science fiction crap of why nautical miles are blah, blah, blah. But anyways, So now it's all the way out in the horizon, right? Remember, it's dark and this is like a big light, so it's clear to see even when it's way out there. So it's a couple miles away. And then this light starts rushing towards them again. And it's going like full speed towards them, and all the men are like wondering what to do. And then it just stops a few feet away from the boat and just sits there. And then it just vanishes. Pop, light's gone. And then, pop, the light reappears on the other side of the boat. And everybody's trying to wonder what to do. And Aranax says, quote, "You have no further doubt, Captain, of the nature of the animal?" Captain, "No, sir. It is evidently a gigantic narwhal and an electric one." End quote. So they're like, oh, yeah, it's definitely a giant electric narwhal at this point.
Oh, my God. That's so scary.
Right? That would actually be like, could you imagine like lightning arcing off that unicorn horn and all that?
Cool.
He's just going pew pew and shooting his little lightning bolts at the boat.
Yeah, you D&D players out there, take note. You D&D DMs, because I've got a monster for you. So they, because of the how fast this thing is moving, the fact that it's disappearing and reappearing, they decide, look, we really can't fight this thing at night. What are we going to do? So they just keep trucking on until daylight. They get all ready. They get their guns ready. They get their harpoons ready. They're ready to fight. But they're just trucking along, and the light stays with them. It's like following them. Sometimes it disappears, but then later it reappears with the occasional sound of, quote, "a deafening whistling, like that produced by a body of water rushing with great violence," end quote. So it's like spouting occasionally while it's like buzzing around them while they're just trucking along in the dark, just waiting for an opportunity to fight it. So over the hours, sometimes it disappears, and then it comes back, and then it disappears for a long time, and they start to think, uh-oh, we lost it. But then it's morning again, the sun comes up, and who spots it? Ned Land, baby, he spots it again.
That's $100,000 he's just earned.
I mean, you could argue that. You could argue that. So there's this big dark shape just above the waves. It's about 250 feet long. Someone else can convert that to meters for me. I'm taking these measurements from the book. So it's about 250 feet long, big dark shape, and they see the two water spouts spray up, and it's true that they're like 100 feet in the air, like this is a ridiculous water spout. So they decide, all right, it's on the surface, it's light, now's the time to go for it. And the commander says, all right, put on the steam, here we go. And they charge towards it, but then it starts moving away from them, and they can't catch it. It's just like casually trucking along in front of them. So the commander, there's like the series of the commander saying like, put on more steam if you can. And they do. And Aranax is like, oh, we were going so fast. But then it just speeds up and they can't catch it. Quote, "We heaved the log and calculated that the Abraham Lincoln was going at the rate of 18 and a half miles an hour. But the accursed animal swam too at the rate of 18 and a half miles per hour. End quote. So it just keeps doing this. Ned Land has like a harpoon in his right hand and is holding on to the boat with his left hand and is literally hanging off the front of the boat like to harpoon this thing. So they chase it for hours and hours, but every time they try to speed up, it speeds up. They increase speed, it goes faster. They increase speed, it goes faster. But then it speeds up so much, it literally starts running circles around them.
Damn.
So they decide to shoot the big gun at it. Because they're like, all right, fine. So after a couple shots, they hit it with the big gun. But the bullet, quote, "hit the animal, but not fatally, and sliding off the rounded surface was lost in 2 miles depths of sea," end quote. So basically the bullet like bounces off of it. So they chase it all the way into the night, from morning all the way into the night, with no progress. They're still chasing it, they're still trying, but they already shot it, they can't catch it, and as it gets dark, they lose it, it's gone. And they assume, all right, we're done, we tried, we can't catch it. But then the light appears again in the darkness, in the water, and it's stationary and it's not moving. It's just sitting there, even as their boat moves. And so they think, oh, this thing must be like sleeping with its light on. And they say, okay, this is like our only chance, right? So they put on a little bit of steam because they don't want to be too loud, and they start going towards this thing. Ned lands hanging off the front still with his harpoon. They get close to it, and Ned throws his harpoon. And the harpoon hits it, and as soon as the harpoon hits it, the light goes out. And all of a sudden, there's like this huge whistling sound, and two blasts of water come out of this thing, right across the deck, and it bowls over several guys, and Aranax, who is watching, gets a blast right to the chest, gets knocked off the boat, and now he's off in the ocean. And that's the end of that chapter. Chapter 7, An Unknown Species of Whale. So Aranax is a pretty good swimmer. He regains consciousness, and he swims to the surface. It's very dark. He reckons it's around 11 p.m. now, somehow. And he is looking around, and he realizes the dark shape and lights of his ship are, like, he looks around for him, and he sees them, and they're, like, off in the horizon. They're so far away. And he thinks, oh, no, this is really bad. He starts trying to swim for it, but he's wearing like all of his 1800s clothes and they're too much for him. They're constricting him and he cries for help and he starts sinking and he's about ready to drown out in the middle of the ocean in the dark by himself. When all of a sudden he's grabbed and pulled up and he realizes it's Conseil. And if you want to hear bromance, listen to this quote. "Is it you?" said I. "You?" "Myself," answered Conseil, "and waiting master's orders." "That shock threw you as well as me into the sea?" "No, but being in my master's service, I followed him." The worthy fellow thought that was but natural. End quote.
Mm.
Yeah.
Aw, so romantic. If you die, I die.
That's Conseil, man. I'm telling you. Their bromance is lovely. It's so cute. So Conseil is now dragging Aranax. And he said he heard the men saying the ship's screw and rudder were broken. So the screw is like basically the propeller. And, you know, the rudder's what steers it. And so basically the Abraham Lincoln is screwed. Because he heard some people talking that, like, after they contacted this boat, that the screw and the rudder are broken, and so they're screwed. But Conseil is completely calm, because Conseil is never anything but calm. This guy is resolute. So he takes a knife and he helps Aranax out of some of his heavier clothes so Ooh. That he can swim. I know, right? It's getting heated
wink,
now.
Wink, wink.
Yeah. And Aranax does the same and helps Conseil out of his clothes.
Oh, oh my no. goodness. Right. This is turning into an erotic novel.
Right. So anyways, they're out in the dark in the middle of the ocean and they start swimming. And they realize, all right, we need to be more efficient about this. So they have this system where Aranax starts laying on his back and just floating while Conseil pushes him. And then they switch, right? And Conseil lays on the and floats and Aranax pushes him. After a while, Aranax starts to cramp up. And he says to Conseil, you know, go on without me, leave me. And Conseil straight up says he'd rather drown than leave him. So, yeah, so beautiful. Romance. So at this point, Aranax has lost all strength. He's cramping up. He can't swim anymore. And Conseil occasionally, while he's swimming, is kind of like lifting his head up and yelling help to see if anyone will respond. But then eventually he yells help. And Aranax at this point is on the brink of passing out. And someone responds to Conseil. But Aranax can't tell who it is because he's about to pass out. So he does pass out and he starts to sink. And Conseil has some trouble dragging him. But after Aranax faints, he is struck by a hard body, quote, hard body.
Oh.
that it brings him up out of the water. So he wakes up and he's laying on a hard surface and Conseil and Ned Land are standing over him. Ned says that he was thrown overboard too, but he was fortunate because he landed next to a, quote, floating island. So Ned says his harpoon didn't pierce the beast because the beast is made of iron. And at this point, it becomes clear, and Aranax puts two and two together, this thing is actually a gigantic submarine. And it's on the surface now, and they're both on top of it, and it's holding them on the surface. So it's important to note the first successful submarines were just being invented in this time period. The idea of a submarine being like a viable ship was still kind of nuts. Like the American Civil War experimented with some submarines, but like, yeah, this is some science fiction crap
yeah.
at this point. So the ship begins moving across the water. So as Aranax recovers, they start looking around for an entrance or an opening, but this thing is solid steel. They can't even find really like a seam. Luckily, it moves on the surface and it doesn't dive for now until the morning sun comes up. And they're still on top of this thing, wondering what they're going to do. And that's when it starts going down. And at this point, they figure they're absolutely screwed because Abraham Lincoln isn't anywhere around anymore. So Ned Land just starts stomping on the boat like everywhere he can and yelling that, you know, stop and stop doing this. We need help. They're starting to panic. And then suddenly one of the big steel iron plates moves. And a man appears, pops his head up. He yells something in a language that none of them recognize. And then he just disappears back into the hole. And then, quote, some moments after, 8 strong men with masked faces appeared noiselessly and drew us down into their formidable machine, end quote. And that's the end of that chapter.
Nice. Saved.
They woke him up.
You think they were sleeping in there?
Yeah, he was cranky. He's like, who the heck's banging on my door?
Like, dude, excuse me? Do you know what time it is?
Chapter 8, Mobilis in Mobili. So, Conseil, Ned Land, and the narrator, Aranax, are all rushed down a ladder into darkness. And they're shut into a completely, absolutely dark room. So, they're talking to each other a bit. Ned Land is ready to fight his way out, and he says, oh, I'll fight anybody. And Aranax suggests, hold on, we don't know where we are, we don't know who these people are, we need to be reasonable about this. They start feeling around this completely dark room, and they determine the room is about 20 feet by 10 feet. It has a table in there, and there's apparently some stools, and there appears to be a carpet on the floor. There doesn't seem to be a door. It's all perfectly smooth. And then all of a sudden, a bright overhead light suddenly comes on, like a globe light. And they visually confirm that, yes, they're in a 20 by 10 foot room and has a table and stools and carpets, but they still can't see a door even with the light on. After a bit, they're waiting there trying to figure out what to do. Part of the wall opens. So there's like hermetically sealed doors that are like perfectly, perfectly sealed. And two men come in. And they're wearing sea otter caps and sealskin boots and like warm like sea wear and stuff. There's a shorter man. And then there's this taller, much more impressive man that he describes, the author describes as, quote, whether this person was 35 or 50 years of age, I could not say. He was tall, had a large forehead, straight nose, a clearly cut mouth, beautiful teeth, with fine taper hands. This man was certainly the most admirable specimen I had ever met, end quote.
He called him beautiful.
He's fawning.
Yeah, watch out, Conseil. There's a competitor now. Yeah, so these men just stand there quietly. They examine the captives, they look them over, and then the taller one speaks to the shorter one in an unknown language. It's the same kind of speech as before. None of them recognize the language. So they decide they need to explain themselves. So Aranax tries to speak to him in French, but he doesn't seem to understand. He introduces themselves and tells the story of how they arrived and how they got on this ship. And both of them listen, especially the tall man listens very attentively, but they're just stony, poker-faced, absolutely silent. They don't say another word. So Aranax speaks French and English and German. So he tries the whole story again, but he says, oh, Ned, your English is better than mine. You tell them the story in English. So Ned tells the whole story of how they got there and who they are in English. And again, they watch Ned Land attentively, and they're completely silent, and they don't say or do anything. And then Conseil says, well, my German's pretty good. I'll try German. And he does the whole story again in German. And again, they watch them attentively, politely, never move, never make a sound. And so then Pierre Aranax says, okay, I know some Latin, and he tries Latin. He's not very good at it. And the exact same thing, no reaction whatsoever. After all these stories are over and they're starting to get a little frustrated, the two men speak a word or two in their strange language, and then they just leave and shut the door behind them. So they're alone in this little room again for a bit, and Ned Land is pretty angry. You know, they're like being kept captive, and clearly they don't understand and all this stuff. And of course, Conseil is perfectly calm because he's Conseil. And Aranax says, hey, we all need to be patient. So later on, a different man comes in wearing the same kind of gear. They figure he's a steward. He brings in clothes, fresh clothes for them, because remember they cut their clothes off. And three plates, but he does not say a word. He does not react to them. He pretends like they're not there, and then he leaves. They're served good, clean water and food. They're served some very good fish. And, quote, some, although excellent, I could give no opinion. Neither could I tell what kingdom they belonged, whether animal or vegetable, end quote. So they're given some kind of weird food, but it's pretty good. And the dinner actually feels very fancy. And he comments that, like, wow, it was like being in a really nice hotel because they give us this very nice dinner. The reason why the chapter is called this is because every fork, spoon, knife has engraved on it the words Mobilis in Mobili, N, with like the letter N at the end. And he says the letter N was no doubt the initial of the name of this enigmatical person. So he figures N must be stands for the leader of this group or something. And they all are feeling pretty well fed and they're all exhausted. So they all fall asleep. And that's the end of that chapter.
I don't know why Ned is so... Oh, does the N stand for Ned? I don't know why he's so upset. It's either that or be in the ocean with sharks in the dark.
Yeah, I think the summary, Ned Land is angry, Conceal is calm, and Aronnax recommends patience, like, describes this book in, like, a sentence. Ned Land is always, always angry. In fact... Chapter 9, Ned Land's Tempers.
Ooh. So, wait, does he have a hook for a hand? Because he's giving me hook for a hand vibes.
Oh, he totally should, but he doesn't. No.
It helped hold him onto the front of the boat, you know?
Yeah.
When hanging over with the spear. Yeah.
It would make him look even more badass if he threw the harpoons with the hook. You'd be like, dude, how does he do
how
that?
Does he
you know?
Do it?
Or if he had like some sort of hook apparatus that was designed to help him throw harpoons.
Ooh.
Wow.
Ooh, or the hook could be the harpoon and be retractable, just like a grappling hook.
There we go.
A grappling harpoon. Oh my god. Wait.
A full steampunk version of this book. I might read a steampunk version of this book. So Aronnax wakes up, and apparently someone has cleared the table while they were asleep, but nothing else has changed besides. They're still in the same room. And he notices that the air is getting stale and harder to breathe. So he starts being logical about this, and he's like, okay, if the air feels like it has more CO2 in it, I'm guessing we're underwater, because this thing is clearly a submarine. And he starts to wonder about, like, how does this thing get its air back? And then all of a sudden there's a rush of pure air that helps him breathe. And he notices that there's a vent above the space where the door was. And so he comes to the conclusion from the motions and the air that they must have just come back to the surface to resupply their air. And he concludes that, okay, this thing must, like, go to the surface every now and then and, like, replenish all of its undersea air. And then the others wake up, Ned Land and Conceal, and Aronnax tells them his air conclusions. He's like, oh, this is what I think, and, you know, I think we're underwater, and I think we're on the surface now. They think they've slept for, like, more than 24 hours at this point, they guess, and they're all very hungry, and hours and hours and hours go by after they wake up, and Ned Land is starting to get really angry. He yells, you know, he's like, hey, someone, let us out, you know, where are you people? And no one responds. They don't hear anything at all. They don't hear, like, people or movement or anything, which is a little weird. And Aronnax thinks that, you know, hey, I don't even hear any, like, movement of water or anything. I think we're absolutely still right now. And it's absolutely deadly quiet. And, yeah, once again, there's a one-line paragraph that really sums up a lot of this book. Quote, I felt terrified. Conceal was calm. Ned Land roared. End quote. Which, yeah, Aronnax is either recommending they're patient or he's scared out of his gourd. Conceal is always calm and Ned Land is always angry. So, finally, the door opens and the steward appears, the same guy who brought them food earlier. And again, he's absolutely silent. He doesn't look at them. He pretends like they're not there. And Ned Land loses it. He rushes this guy and tackles him and starts choking him. And Conceal and Aronnax are, like, trying to stop him while he's wrestling with this guy. When suddenly they hear a voice say in French, quote, be quiet, Master Land, and you, Professor, will you be so good as to listen to me? End quote. And that's the end of the chapter.
I am so confused with what's going on right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little weird, a little wacky.
Wait, so the rest of their crew just, like, is off on the Abraham Lincoln and they're just going straight because they can't turn? And they're just out at sea?
Yeah, they might be dead, actually.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Chapter 10, The Man of the Seas. So the French words came from a guy who's standing in the door, and it's the tall man from before, the fantastic specimen or whatever. And so they kind of conclude that he's probably the commander. So Ned Land stops choking the steward. The steward stumbles away, again, without saying a word or anything, and leaves. And there's this awkward silence while Ned and Conceal and Aronnax are staring at this commander guy. He just kind of looks them over quietly, his arms folded in front of him. And then he says, in perfect French, without an accent or anything, quote, gentlemen, said he in a calm and penetrating voice, I speak French, English, German, and Latin equally well. I could therefore have answered you at our first interview, but I wished to know you first, then to reflect. The story told by each one, entirely agreeing in the main points, convinced me of your identity. I know now that chance has brought before me, Monsieur Pierre Aronnax, professor of natural history at the Museum of Paris, entrusted with a scientific mission abroad, Conseil, his servant, and Ned Land of Canadian origin, harpooner on board the frigate Abraham Lincoln of the Navy of the United States of America. End quote.
So this is like what inspired Rush Hour with Chris Tucker. Like, do you understand the words that are coming to my mouth? Jackie yeah, exactly. Chan's like, you just assumed I couldn't speak English.
I'm sure they thought that. He's like, you understand the words coming out of my mouth? And Jackie Chan is like, that's straight from Jules Verne. And they're like, yeah.
yeah, exactly.
Did you ever read 20,000 League Under the Sea? Uncultured swine. So Nemo says he took a long time considering what to do with them. He spent some time trying to plan what he was going to do. Quote, most annoying circumstances have brought you into the presence of a man who has broken all the ties of humanity. You have come to trouble my existence. End quote. So this is the first hint we get that this commander is like a hermit or like kind of a weird exile type person. So they decide they need to explain themselves. So Aronnax explains the news of the monster. He says, look, you have to understand there's, you know, all this international news of this, whatever this is, that's like, you know, causing trouble. And the captain is just having none of it. He doesn't want to listen to this. And he straight up says, you know, I have the right to leave you on the deck and then go underwater and just let you drown. Which is, you know, like a pretty direct threat. And Aronnax says that, well, that would be something like a really uncivilized person would get. And this is like a hot button word for the captain. When he says that's not something a civilized man would do, the captain gets angry and says, quote, Professor, replied the commander quickly, I am not what you call a civilized man. I have done with society entirely for reasons which I alone have the right of appreciating. I do not therefore obey its laws, and I desire you never to allude them to them before me again. End quote. So that's a little disturbing. So, anyways, the captain says, look, you're here, and I could let you drown, but instead, I'm going to let you live on my boat. On a couple conditions. One, I can shut you in your cabin whenever I want. You basically have to listen to whatever I say. And two, you're not allowed to leave. And he justifies this with, quote, you came to surprise a secret which no man in the world must penetrate, the secret of my whole existence. And you think that I'm going to send you back to what world which must know me no more? Never. In retaining you, it is not you whom I guard. It is myself. End quote.
Imagine, like, being taken captive unwillingly into a submarine. Like, going into a submarine willingly causes people cabin fever. Imagine, like, being there against your will. That's just terrifying.
Yeah.
Is he like a convicted felon? And he's like, you can't let anyone know I still exist.
It's
and
Elvis.
He's a runaway. And
yeah, at this point, they're speculating, right? Like, this guy could be anything. But now they're basically prisoners on this submarine.
They're his prisoner friends. Yeah. He needs like some friends.
Like, the prisoner friends.
Yeah, well, he needs friends, the loner guy. So he's like, hey, perfect. Look at this. I can either let you guys die or we can all hang out forever.
It's me, your warden. hold still while I hobble you real quick so you can't move. Oh, man. Yeah, so this is a submarine misery. Yep. So they're basically prisoners, but it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because the next thing he says is the mysterious commander, he does say, you know, you're my prisoners, but you will actually enjoy yourselves, right? He says, quote, you are going to visit the land of marvels, end quote. So yeah, he is kind of like, you're going to be my prisoner friends, which is a little weird.
Could be worse.
Yeah, and then he says, oh, he's very learned, he's read a lot of books. In fact, he's read Pierre Aronnax's book. Like a bunch of times, and he respects Pierre Aronnax as like the most expert man on the undersea world who hasn't actually been to the undersea world. And then he introduces himself. He says his name is Captain Nemo.
Ooh.
And this nice. Boat, yep, their submarine, this boat that they're on is called the Nautilus. So if you've ever heard of Captain Nemo or Nautilus, if you've ever watched like there's a really bad movie called The League of Extraordinary Men. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-mm.
Don't blame me, it was bad. this is the famous Captain Nemo.
I thought it was from Finding Nemo. I got really excited.
Well, that's where Nemo comes from. But anyways, So he takes them out of the room that they're in, and he starts giving them a tour of the Nautilus. And the first room they enter is like this big, fancy wood-paneled dining room. Everything in here is obscenely fancy. It's very impressive. So they sit down at the dining room, they eat a fancy breakfast, and all of the food is from the ocean. Captain Nemo explains all their food comes from the sea. He has, quote, renounced the food of the earth, end quote. So they're eating dolphin. I know, don't hate me. This is in the book. They're eating dolphin, turtle, holothuria, which is like a sea cucumber, and cream made from whale milk. Yeah, it's weird.
How do they capture whale milk?
That's a good question. They don't actually go into that.
They filter it out of the seawater?
Yeah, exactly. See, this is the science fiction stuff I want. Like, explain to me the details of harvesting whale milk.
I'd rather not know, actually.
Also, how do they get fresh water?
Oh, that's a good question, too. I think they do go into this.
Just take the salt out.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, can they also do that to Ned's attitude?
There we go. Run him through the machine.
Yeah, that's good.
Right? Yeah.
So Captain Nemo is talking about, while they're sitting at dinner, how much he loves the sea and how he's like a child of the ocean and blah, blah, blah. And then Nemo takes Aranax into a large, fancy, wood-paneled library. It's this huge library. There's couches, bookshelves, desks, a big table, and what they estimate, what Captain Nemo says is 12,000 books. And so Aranax is super happy about this. And they smoke a cigar together, and Aranax is starting to think maybe this isn't going to be so bad. And then they go to a large, what they call a drawing room. It's the museum. There's many paintings by famous artists. He says there's stuff in there, a Madonna of Raphael, a Virgin of Leonardo da Vinci, a Woman of Titan, whatever that means. But like, yeah, there's like a lot of big names. He's got like a lot of super expensive art in here. So Aranax is just amazed at this. He's got a bunch of marble and bronze statues in here, a large organ with like a bunch of famous works by famous composers, and many glass cases with rare sea specimens. And again, this is hitting like a hot button topic with Aranax, because he's just all about sea creatures, and he's just utterly amazed by this giant museum.
So Conseil really has to worry now. He's got competition.
Big time.
Yeah. And here we see a bit when he sees the sea specimens. Here's reason number one, again, of why I don't like science fiction, that it's more about science than the plot. Because you're going to notice one hell of a pattern with this book. So he looks in the specimens and the book says, quote, in the first group, the tubipores were gorgons arranged like a fan, soft sponges of Syria, Isis of the Moluccas, Penatules, an admirable Virgularia of the Norwegian seas, variegated Umbellaria, Alcyonaria, a whole series of madrepores, Asteri, sea stars, Pantacrinae, Comatules, Asterophons, Echini, Holothurae. It goes on like this for paragraphs. So, like, if you're really into sea ocean taxonomy, again, this book is for you, because holy crap, do they do this a lot?
I understood all but two of those.
Really?
All right.
No. No, of course not.
I didn't know. I thought maybe you were like some closet ocean taxonomy person. Just like, oh, man.
And yet I asked what a knot was earlier.
Well, you don't have to know a nautical mile per hour is to wonder about fish and algae and stuff.
Taylor, I knew what all of those were, but I just keep my mouth shut about it so I don't annoy people like you.
Brian is like, oh yeah, haha, really bad. And then secretly he's like, oh my God.
Yeah, this sucks.
This is, oh, tell me more about the taxonomy.
Awesome.
Oh my God.
What page was that on? Sorry, can you just, I want to
so find avoid it
for reference.
So I can avoid it. Tell me where. Oh man. So in this museum, there's also like these weird scientific instruments on the wall in this room. And Aranax tells the captain he's very excited to learn about the Nautilus and like all these instruments and stuff. Captain Nemo leads him out of the drawing room, this museum, and he shows him the room that Aranax is going to stay in and his own room next to it. And Nemo's own room has the same instruments in there that are like meters and stuff. They go to the saloon, what they call the saloon, which is like a relaxing area. And Nemo starts to explain the Nautilus. And that's the end of that chapter. Chapter 11, All by Electricity, which you might be able to tell by the name of the title of the chapter, but reason number two why I don't like science fiction is it doesn't age well.
Right.
Because this chapter is all about the futuristic wonders of the world of electricity.
Dude, it's cool to look back, though. For instance, I rewatched Back to the Future recently, and that movie, like the second one, is based in 2015. And they think there's going to be like cars and like Mr. Coffee type nuclear reactors and like all this stuff. And it's just so funny to look back and see how they think that, you know, the near-ish future is going to be and how off it is.
Yeah, no, I will admit the retrofuturism is kind of cool. But yeah, the thing about science fiction, though, is that it is science fiction and it's based off the science of the time, which means that anytime you speculate on the future, you're going to get stuff wrong.
Right.
That being said, I think that these speculations in this book, I mean, I'm not an electrician, are fairly accurate. Like, he makes some guesses about, like, communication systems around the ship, which are actually pretty close. And in that regard, it's pretty impressive. It's just, to me, this isn't plot, but that's, yeah. Which is actually something else that's going to be hit on, that will be hit on in part two that I just wrote some notes about. It's kind of funny.
It's not the only thing that's going to be hit on, huh, Conceal? Look at
that. Not if Nemo has anything to say about it. Because Nemo is about to touch Aranax's science button. Because here we go. All
right.
So Captain Nemo starts explaining all the instruments and their purpose, starting with the ones that Aranax knows about. So he points to all the stuff on the wall and he's like, this is the thermometer, this is the barometer, this is the sextant, etc. So Aranax asks about the ones that he doesn't know. And here's a quote from the book. Quote, "There is a powerful agent, obedient, rapid, easy, which conforms to every use and reigns supreme on board my vessel. Everything is done by means of it. It lights it, warms it, and is the soul of my mechanical apparatus. This agent is electricity." Electricity? I cried in surprise. Yes, sir. End quote. So, yeah, like the fact that this thing runs on electricity is like mind-blowing, right? At the time, I suppose. So Aranax is absolutely stunned. He says, electricity couldn't possibly have this much power to move this ship. And here's another quote. Quote, "Professor," said Captain Nemo, "my electricity is not everybody's. You know what seawater is composed of. In 1,000 grams are found 96.5% of water and about 2 2/3% of chloride of sodium. Then, in smaller quantity, chlorides of magnesium and of potassium, bromide of magnesium, sulfate of magnesia, and sulfate and carbonate of lime," end quote. So again, like, if you, like, really get into this stuff, man, do I have a book for you. But he's, like, describing his electricity, and basically he says that he's got this process that takes in seawater, extracts the chemicals, and that's what makes electricity. Which obviously turned out to basically be false, but, like, I guess you can do that. I don't know, Brian might know more than I do.
All the stuff he listed were electrolytes. Like...
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, apparently, according to you, of course, like, that is not sound science, but it's an interesting take on how a submarine could be, like, self-sustaining in perpetuity.
Right. This is very much Jules Verne's Wouldn't It Be Cool If.
Yeah, that's the fiction part, I guess.
Yeah.
It could be fueled by Gatorade.
Yeah, yeah.
Electrolytes. Because
it's got electrolytes.
Yeah, it does.
This is not a political podcast.
Gatorade's not political.
We're not even getting into the realism, the prescience of the people who wrote Idiocracy and how much more accurate they were than Jules Verne. But anyways, so he says, I use the seawater to make electricity, and it basically makes like unlimited electricity. He says he could manufacture his own air too, rather than go to the surface. But basically he's got commands of the seas and he can go to the surface whenever he wants. So there's no point in doing that. He says electricity powers everything, the pumps, the screw that drives the ship, the lights, everything. And then he says, come with me, and they go to see a tour of like the other parts of the boat. There's a small auxiliary boat. They go up to the platform, the top, and he shows them the small auxiliary boat that can be launched from the depths. It's connected by a telegraph wire, apparently. And they go into some details about that I kind of forget. They see the kitchen, the bathroom, Conceal and Ned's cabin, and the engineer room. And then here's reason number one for me, where, again, I don't read books for fake science. Some people do, but again, here we go. Quote, you see, said the captain, I use Bunsen's contrivances, not Ruhmkorff's. Those would not have been powerful enough. Bunsens are fewer in number, but strong and large, which experience proves to be the best. The electricity produced passes forward, where it works by electromagnets of great size on a system of levers and cogwheels that transmit the movement of the axle of the screw. This one, the diameter of which is 19 feet, and the thread 23 feet, performs about 120 revolutions in a second, end quote. So this whole chapter is like details about the boat and how the electricity works and that sort of stuff. So of course this touches Aronnax's science button. and he wants more. He wants to know more. So Nemo invites him into the saloon, the relaxing room. And that's the end of that chapter.
So he can talk dirty to him more.
Come with me to the saloon.
Talk science.
And yeah, I'll tell you more about my electricity.
I'll show you my electric boat. Chapter 12. Some Figures. So yeah, this chapter is called Some Figures because, holy God, reason number one for me is, wow, if you like fake scientific figures, again, wow, because that's all this chapter is. The entire chapter is literally Captain Nemo explaining the mathematics and physics of his boat, while Aronnax excitedly responds with, like, well, how does that work? And surely, according to this theory, that can't be possible. And Captain Nemo says, oh, ho, yes, it is. And he explains to him how. Right? And Aronnax is just, you know, this is his wet dream. It's fantastic to him.
It's the inside baseball chapter.
Yeah, I guess. So, basically, the numbers that they go over, and they do go over a lot of actual numbers, like I'm just glancing at the chapter, density of water, weight of water per volume, depth, pressure, like all kinds of crap like that. But basically, the points to take away is this. One, the Nautilus has nearly limitless power from its magical electricity source. Two, the Nautilus is big. It's about 232 feet long. It's kind of shaped like a cigar. And it's 26 feet at its widest. Three, it can go up and down whenever it wants and wherever it wants. Four, there's a steersman driving the boat. He's basically in a very thick glass case. Think like submersible style that's like towards the front of the boat. It has very bright lights to see in the dark, obviously. We knew this because of the lights around the surface of the ocean. And he built it in secret by buying all the parts from separate places around the world, which were assembled by Nemo's private worker team on a desert island. So that's how he built the thing. So the chapter ends with, here's a quote for you. Quote, Monsieur Aronnax, an iron vessel costs 145 pounds per ton. Now the Nautilus weighed 1,500. It came, therefore, to 67,500 pounds and 80,000 pounds more for fitting it up, and about 200,000 pounds with the works of art and the collections it contains. End quote.
Cheap.
So, yeah, this is 1870, and they're using pounds, which I'm assuming are British pounds in 1870. But apparently, if you add that all up, ChatGPT says basically that means that everything in this boat is about $88 million in modern American dollars.
It's a Hyundai.
That's a lot of money to put into one singular structure, and assuming it's not going to get a hole and you're going to lose all your art.
Yeah.
God, I'd be so nervous.
I actually wonder how he got a hold of some of these art pieces, and like some government is like, hey, actually, can we have that back, please? Right? Like that. No. I assume there's some shadiness in there. Like there has to be. But the chapter ends basically with this quote that's Aronnax talking to Nemo. And Aronnax says, you are rich? And Nemo says, immensely rich, sir, and I could, without missing it, pay the national debt of France. End quote.
Oh my goodness. Wild. Just wipe him up now. He's rich, he's handsome, he's smart, he's into the same stuff you are.
He has a magic bow.
Conceal just does what you tell him to do.
I know, but Conceal's so dedicated. Oh my God, this is a love triangle.
It is a love triangle.
Man, I take it back. This is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the love triangle. That's what this is. So this one's a long one. That's it for the first part of part one. We'll be back with the second part of part one in the next episode. If you're ready for more super exciting science fiction numbers from Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Bye, y'all.
And a love affair.
Oh, yeah.